history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. Seemingly ordinary Americans with extraordinary stories to tell if we're just willing to take a little time to listen. And that's what we try to do here each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we are entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I certainly hope that's going to be the case today as we approach things a little differently than usual. Instead of just one veteran's life story today, we're going to hear from a few voices that I hope will add depth to the history of one of World War II's most unique and most decorated units. If you've ever cruised through the archives at hometownheroesradio.com, you've seen that there are hundreds of interviews there. And one of the ways I hope to make those podcasts more user-friendly is to organize them by number. Today's show is our 442nd episode, and every time I looked at that, the same thought kept coming into my head. 15 or 20 years ago, the number 442 might not have meant that much to me. In fact, my first thought probably would have been the old Oldsmobile muscle car from the 60s and 70s. But hear that number 442 now, after all these years of meeting hometown heroes all over America, and there's only one thing I can think of. The men who were part of the 442. That's how they often refer to it. The 442, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which, based on its size and length of service, was the most decorated unit in American history. Maybe you remember the motto, "Go for Broke," celebrated in books and film. And if you ever have the chance, I hope you'll visit the Go for Broke National Education Center in Los Angeles, which has done a remarkable job in preserving the history of the 442 and all Japanese American veterans. The bottom line is the men of the 442 risked their lives, and in so many cases gave their lives, for a country that at one point wouldn't even let them serve, a country that was holding so many of their families prisoner solely on the basis of their Japanese ancestry. Before we jump into some of their firsthand accounts, let me give you some big picture background. In just over 2 years of combat, the 442nd was awarded 8 presidential unit citations, including an unbelievable 5 in just 1 month. The regimental strength was a little under 4,000, but in that short time, the unit had to be replaced more than 2 times over because of casualties. A total of about 14,000 Japanese Americans ended up being part of the 442, and the number of Purple Hearts awarded, again in just a 2-year span, more than 9,000. There were 560 Silver Stars awarded to members of the 442, 52 Distinguished Service Crosses, and eventually 21 recipients. 10 of those were killed in action in World War II, including the first one, Sadao Munemori, a 22-year-old private from Southern California who had joined the Army before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. When he woke up in Seravezza, Italy on April 5, 1945, he knew his parents and siblings were still incarcerated at the Manzanar internment camp in California. He had already participated in the rescue of the Lost Battalion the previous fall. More on that event later. For now, I'll let his Medal of Honor citation tell the rest of his story. When his unit was pinned down by grazing fire from the enemy's strong mountain defense and command of the squad devolved on him with the wounding of its regular leader, he made frontal one-man attacks through direct fire and knocked out 2 machine guns with grenades. Withdrawing under murderous fire and showers of grenades from other enemy emplacements, he had nearly reached a shell crater occupied by 2 of his men when an unexploded grenade bounced on his helmet and rolled toward his helpless comrades. He arose into the withering fire, dived for the missile, and smothered its blast with his body. By his swift, supremely heroic action, PFC Munemori saved 2 of his men at the cost of his own life and did much to clear the path for his company's victorious advance. Clearly, Sadao Munomori exemplified the go-for-broke mentality of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. He never had the chance to tell his story, but we've been able to meet some veterans from the 442 on Hometown Heroes over the years, and we're going to listen to some of their stories throughout the rest of today's program, starting with Robert Yano of Kingsburg, California, who appeared on this program shortly after all Japanese-American World War II veterans. He took us back to the day the world changed, December 7th, 1941. He was playing a basketball game when he found out what had happened at Pearl Harbor.
I was playing with the Japanese-American basketball, you might say, club team that we had.
Oh, okay.
It belonged in Parlor, which they call Young Men's Club.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us had different teams in that area. And that particular day, we were down in Ninzi playing a game. And that's where we picked up the story that Pearl Harbor, and we came back to Parlor, and we were just shocked. We all gathered around and talked about it, and then, of course, we all went our way and went home. But that's where it was kind of a shock when we really heard about it.
Did you sense things starting to change after that day in terms of Kingsburg and the surrounding area?
I think it started to show. It started to show. You had the feeling, and you could just have the feeling. I mean, just something's, you know, the feeling of other people. Maybe they thought maybe we had something to do with it. I don't know, but it's just, you can feel it. I felt it.
And you hadn't finished high school yet.
No.
But along in February the next year, along comes Executive Order 9066, and President Roosevelt declares that you, somebody who was born here in the United States, that you're an enemy alien and that you have to go to a relocation camp. I can't imagine what that must have felt like. And how did you deal with that?
Well, you know, at senior at high school, you know, it was the law that you had to register for the draft. And I just turned 18. And, of course, that's what I did. So within a week or so, I got a notice from the local board, 124 in Fresno. It classified me as 1A, which was eligible for draft,
mm-hmm.
which is fine with me. That was what we had to do. But when they took us out and sent me to Arizona, to the camp, well, then it was just a week or so after, then I got a notification saying I was reclassified. I opened it up and says I was 4C. Well, that 4C is enemy alien. You know, that's hard to believe that I became an enemy alien. And I talked to my dad, and my dad had one thing over me. He's an alien, but he had a green card, and I was an alien without anything. So it was kind of dad kind of laughed. We kind of chuckled about it. He told me, he says, well, you're an alien. He says, I got a green card. And he says, well, I know you got one up on me there.
And you brought something with you today that originated from your time there at the Gila River internment camp. It's got all kinds of little red dots on it. It looks like some faded fabric. What's it called, and what's the story behind it?
The story is, this is what you call in Japanese, a sending buddy. Sending buddy means a thousand dots on here. Each dot is put by a lady.
Uh-huh.
And if you wear this around your waist, never take it off, that you'll survive the war and come back.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was in Gila camp, before I was going overseas, a lady came up to me and says, I want you to have this. I want you to wear it. Take it. So I know that your mom isn't here. So I had all these ladies put these dots on for you. I don't know if you knew anything about it, but I heard about it before through Japanese culture.
Sure.
That this is what they wore, the soldiers wore, before they went to the war. They wore it around their waist, never take it off. And I did. And I took it, and I wore it around my waist. And it's unbelievable, but it was around my waist. You couldn't tell whether it was white, blue, black, or what. But when I got out after, I brought it home. At the time after I got married, I showed my wife, and she says, what's that? So I had to explain. She knew what it was about. But she says, well, can't wash it, because if you wash it with real hard soap, it'll take out the dot. So I says, okay. She says, you just wash clear, cold water, and this is what remained. It's still intact as far as the dots are concerned.
That's impressive. I've never seen one of those before. And what does it mean to you now when you see it, when you haven't seen it for a while and your eyes happen to catch it? What does it remind you of? What does it make you think of?
Well, it reminds me of camp. The most regret I have now And after all that, is not remembering that lady that gave it to me.
Mm.
And I know she meant it from the bottom of her heart, because I'm sure she had kids of her own too, but she brought it to me thinking that, well, this would bring me home. I still take it with me wherever I go and show people this is what it is. And I take it to all the schools, and they're probably in the high school, they're kind of awe, because they just can't believe it. Something like this, you know, has gone, you know, on. You know.
Mm-hmm. That was with you in the Vosges Mountains and everywhere you were with the 442nd.
All the way, all the way over and all the way back, up in the mountains, down the mountains, wherever. Yeah.
But so far, you're still in the camp. How did you end up in the military? After you're classified 1A, they change it to 4C, you're stuck there in the camp. How'd you get out?
Well, they opened up and then start opening the draft and whatnot, and this is where I signed up and decided, well, this is, I guess this is my part to go, because I was expecting that anyway, you know, and I felt that this is something that I have to do.
Even though you knew that other members of your family would still be stuck there in the camp, you're going to go fight for a government that's doing that to your family.
Yeah, it didn't bother me. I just felt that this is part of it. That mm-hmm. probably maybe this is, will show that, you know, this is that we are loyal Americans. And one thing I could say, my dad never said it. He just said that you do what you're supposed to do. You were born here. You do what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Did you understand that you'd be serving in a segregated unit?
Yes. Yes, I knew that.
Was that a good thing, do you think? I mean, did that help to know that the guys around you were in the same boat as you?
Well, I mean, never even gave it a thought about that. I mm-hmm. just figured that I was going to be in the U.S. Army, and that's it.
So here you are, a 19-year-old BAR man, Browning Automatic Rifle, with the Go for Broke unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Your dad was in the Gila River internment camp, but tell us about what happened to your mother.
My mother went back in July of 41.
Mm-hmm.
The two sisters, Auntie and my mom, went back for a visit. And so they were there, and then they were returning back to the United States. The boat came back to Seattle Way. Halfway, they turned around and went back.
Mm.
And so from the story that we received later on is that my mother got sick, and she had an operation, and they thought it was appendix. It wasn't appendix. It was, I don't know what you'd call it in English, but your intestines, they twist and they do something. Anyway, she passed away there.
Mm.
So.
But you didn't know this at the time.
I didn't know at the time. I was overseas then, and none of us knew. It was probably a year or two later, through the Red Cross, my dad and my brother got the information that she had passed away there. That was the only communication we had. So after the war was over, then I decided that Mom was still there. I didn't know that she was gone. So I says, well, I'll hook up again, and maybe I can go to the Pacific and go to Japan.
Mm.
Well, in the meantime, my dad and my brother says, well, you come on home. They didn't want to tell me. They says, you come on home first before you go. And so this is what I did. And when I got home, they says, no, there's no use going. Mom has passed away. And then they explained to me how she passed away and everything. But that was pretty hard.
Wow. That makes it even more unimaginable for me to put myself in your shoes, knowing that your dad is in a camp. You don't even know where your mom is.
Yeah, correct.
Maybe in a country that your own country is bombing.
Correct.
But here you are out there fighting with all these other Japanese American in a unit that say whatever you want about it. Every superlative you can attach to the 442nd has been attached. The Gopher Broke unit, the most decorated unit of World War II. So many casualties, and you're one of the fortunate ones. You were never wounded during the war.
No, I didn't.
You must be pretty shifty. You must be able to
avoid. Well, I'll tell you, I had a big log over my hole every time I dug in.
It's well documented, the extreme casualties suffered by your unit, the 442nd in World War II. What would you say was your closest call, the time where you thought for sure this was going to be it for you?
Well, I think this was for one of my squad men right behind me. He was dug in, and he got hit, and it was just, well, he just got hit, and he's blown apart. I mean, you couldn't find anything, so they had to pick him up by pieces. And another fellow right behind me, dug in. He got hit behind, but he didn't. He survived, but he got a shrapnel, real serious shrapnel wound.
So many were wounded, so many killed. And in the end, the valor of the 442 and other Japanese Americans serving in the war had a great impact. The effects sometimes are still unfolding all these years later. But what would you say that you guys proved?
Maybe we proved we're good Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I always proved that I'm a good American.
Amen. What about the significance of that slogan, go for broke? When you think about go for broke, what does that mean to you? And what did it mean to you then?
It means go all out, all out, all you can do.
And why was that the mentality?
I don't know. Just
because you had nothing to lose?
Go for broke. Don't lose.
Your families are already held captive.
Yeah.
I mean, what else are they going to do to them, right? You got to prove it somehow. And there was something from your Japanese culture, a word in Japanese that you'd heard spoken around the home that kind of became your mantra for the war. What was that?
It's gaman. Gaman.
And what does that mean?
That means you just have to take it. Whether mm-hmm. you like it or not, you just take it. Gaman. You just.
And it becomes kind of a test of your will and your character, how much you can take.
That's right. You can take a lot. Human body can take a lot.
I bet you didn't plan on taking as much as you did.
No, but it's a necessity, you might say, sometimes.
So that was Robert Yano. You can access his complete interview at hometownheroesradio.com. Look for episode number 186. Today is episode number 442, and we'll continue with our tribute to the 442nd Regimental Combat Team with the unit's most legendary feat, the rescue of the Lost Battalion, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special tribute to the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the legendary Go for Broke unit of Japanese Americans in World War II. Knowing that today is our 442nd episode of this program, I couldn't resist. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find links to the complete interviews with the vets we're hearing from today, including a two-parter with Lawson Sakai of Morgan Hill, California, who was part of the lopsided casualty count absorbed by the 442 and the unit's most heralded action, the famed rescue of the Lost Battalion in October 1944. He had already been wounded multiple times before that, and that was to be expected, he says. Sakai never expected to come home from the war when he headed overseas.
I didn't think I'd come back.
You really didn't?
No.
You thought this is it?
Yeah.
Were you okay with that?
That's what we signed up for. You know, we're kids. Mm-hmm. When I signed up, I was 18. I'm 20 now going overseas. We all had the same frame of mind. We're going to go out there and do our job. If we get killed, we get killed. You know, that's part of war.
Mm-hmm. So what was your job in the 442nd?
Well, I had a BAR. I was 5'9", mm-hmm. and not big, but probably 4 or 5 inches taller than most of the others, especially the boys from Hawaii who were 5 foot or, you know, mm-hmm. they're small guys. So the bigger guy usually gets the BAR. It's a little heavier.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning, I was just like anybody else in the squads. But after we got overseas, we got into a lot of combat. We had a lot of casualties. We were down to about 50% strength. And short of everybody, and I became the squad leader. We finished up in Italy and moved over to France in August of 1944 and invaded the south of France and gradually went north. And that's where General Dahlquist of the 36th Division that we were attached to then began pushing all of his units because we're only less than 50 miles from the German border. Mm-hmm. He wants to be the first American general to cross Germany. And, of course, right north of us is General Patton. Guess who's going to go first? Well, Eisenhower stopped Patton, mm-hmm. but I don't think Dahlquist knew that. mm-hmm. So by pushing his troops, saying there's no Germans out there, just keep going, that 1st Battalion of the 141st Regiment kept pushing, and they're over 5 miles beyond where the rest of us are. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, the Germans just surrounded them. Hitler's orders were annihilate the Americans, and they were closing in on them. That's why people say the 442nd was used, but Dahlquist sent the 2nd Battalion. They couldn't make a headway. Sent the 3rd Battalion. They didn't make a headway. Then he called the 442nd. And even though we were down to less than 50% strength, we managed to get through. So during that two-week battle, we had over 800 casualties. Over 200 boys were killed. And it was the weather was awful, raining, even snow. A couple of days we had fog so bad the Air Force would not let any planes fly. The conditions were just awful for both Germans and for us. But when the 442nd broke through, there were 211 men left of the 141st 1st Battalion. Mm-hmm. About 50 of them were actually wounded litter people. Usually there's about 18 line officers in a battalion. There were only 3 lieutenants left. We talked to Marty Higgins, who was a senior lieutenant, many years later as we got together. And he told us that they were out of food. The water hole that they could go to was zeroed in by the Germans, so they couldn't go get water. They had no medical supplies. They couldn't treat their wounded. And he said, we had so little ammunition left. We decided to make one last stand and would not have made the day if the 442nd hadn't come through on that day, which was October 30. Mm-hmm. So, but he was whisked away right away with the rest of them. He never knew circumstances of, you know, how it all happened. Well, we met him many years later.
Right. And that perspective, I imagine, left you no doubt as to whether you guys saved their lives.
Well,
I mean, if he tells you they wouldn't have made it, they wouldn't have made it.
We didn't know that at the time.
Right.
You know, we found out later. But our objective, you know, was to chase the Germans out of there. And, you know, that's all you're thinking about. You're not concerned with get those guys rescued. It was just part of the war.
So 211 of them had their lives saved because of your willingness to put yourselves in harm's way. And then you find out later, well, really about 4 times that many casualties among the 442. Is that hard to swallow when you realized it?
Not really. Eventually, we would have had to keep going anyway, you know, because we're trying to chase the Germans back to Germany.
Right.
So the battle has to keep going. We're still at war. So
it's just timing. You're saying all those guys that got wounded would have been wounded eventually?
Yeah, probably.
Including you?
I was wounded badly on the 28th.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't even get to see this eventual liberation of the Lost Battalion. And obviously we want to hear about that. But can you give us a sense, maybe even before that, when you're in this kind of combat, in these kind of conditions, you describe the weather a little bit for us. But as far as the moment to moment and the danger that you feel yourself in and how you keep going, how you keep fighting, how you keep pressing ahead, what were those days like?
It's just really hard to describe the weather was so bad, and of course we didn't have winter clothing, and we were soaking wet from the rain, and the hills were muddy. We're in the Vosges Mountains, the thickest forest that we'd ever been in. And the Germans had the 88-millimeter anti-aircraft weapon, lowered it down, and started shooting it at the infantry. That sound of that 88 going off and exploding, that shrill sound coming, is something that I've never heard duplicated in movies or anything. It's just mind-shattering. And when it comes directly at you, wow, you know, it just, the sound itself is enough to blow you apart. But when it would hit these trees, branches would come off. Sometimes half of a tree would come falling, weighing maybe 1,000 pounds. A lot of guys got crushed. And the morning that I got hit, the 28th of October, we're going to mount a real strong attack at daybreak. And the Germans probably sensed that we were, because we had a big battle on the 27th. We gained the high ground. We dug in as best we could. That early that morning, the barrage came in, probably lasted 20, 25 minutes, maybe more. I don't know. Maybe 100 rounds, just bang, 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 just continuously. We were pinned down. You couldn't move. We had a lot of casualties right at that time. And, of course, when I got it, well, I thought I was dead, so I was out of it. But
I imagine you had probably had some close calls before that.
Yeah, I got wounded twice in Italy and then once before in France. So, but they weren't that bad, you know.
Well, define that, because you say, yeah, I got wounded once. Well, yeah, and most people have never been wounded, period. So when you say weren't that bad, what do you mean?
You know, I got patched up and I could go back a day or two. Mm-hmm. But the last time, the shrapnel that got me in, if it came straight through, it would have blown a hole through me, but it came in at an angle, so it wrapped around in my ribs here. Oh, that was really painful. It just, you know, a red-hot piece of steel in there, and it just, your body just gives way. You just curl up, and you can't breathe, and I was sure I was dead. I remember I told the medic, just let me die right there. And he pumped me full of morphine, because when I woke up, I was on a train, on a litter. They were going to the American Hospital in Dijon, which is not too far away, for surgery. And I don't know how I survived that one. But guys were getting killed left and right. You know, mostly the barrage from the artillery, just a awful shattering of not only the artillery shell, but the tree trunks and limbs coming down. In Italy, we had a few vineyards, a few olive orchards. Most of the hills were bare. Got to France and eastern France, and all of a sudden, this huge forest that we had to go through. The Germans were already entrenched, dug in, so we had to go into the forest, dig them out.
You're going into a meat grinder.
Yeah.
What about your recovery? How long did it take to recover from those wounds?
About 3 months, but not too long after October 30, when the 211 men were rescued, Dahlquist pushed the 442nd for another 4 or 5 days before he let them come off the line.
Right.
We had so few men left. I think I Company had 8 out of 250 or so.
8 out of 250.
Yeah. I think our company, E Company, had probably the most. From what I heard, we had about 40 men left. But the 442nd really couldn't do much in it. They just depleted. So they were sent to southern France, between Italy and France, and a hillside where, like the Maginot Line, they had fortresses built. And the duty was to guard the French-Italian border and the port cities of Cannes, Nice, and that area, patrol all of that. They called it the Champagne Campaign because there was very little battle going on. But there was a few. One of my friends, Sakamoto from the Valley, he got killed there. I think he was about the only one that was killed during that time. Mm-hmm. And the 442nd was there like from the middle of November till April. And that's the time when all these young kids now, the Army changed the designation back to 1A because of what the 442nd was doing. Mm-hmm. So they made them all eligible for the draft and for being drafted. And they were being trained at Camp Shelby. So after about 6 months, they were sent over, and they came in en masse to fill up the 442nd again.
Right. It needed a lot of filling up because of how devastated it was. With those 3 months of recovery for you, were there ever days where you weren't sure you were going to make it? Or you weren't sure you were going to be yourself again?
No, I was in good shape after the surgery. A little painful, of course. But
did you have broken ribs?
Nothing broke. It just... a lot of muscle tear, which is pretty bad.
And there are a lot of internal organs inside your rib cage. I mean, there's a lot of damage that could have been done there.
It didn't go in. It didn't come through. It went around. Mm-hmm. So it just, you know, just luck.
The angle was everything.
Yeah. Just luck.
Was it luck or was somebody looking out for you?
I don't know. And you see guys that... they get hit square in the head with a bullet. Oh, jeez.
Well, here's the other thing that strikes me. Your injury, which almost killed you. I mean, we're talking inches probably from killing you. But now you're, how old are you? 92? Mm-hmm. 92, and you're in better shape than I am.
I don't know about that.
Wearing your 442 belt buckle here today, looking sharp. But had you not been wounded that day, 442 has... a couple more days of combat before they liberate the Lost Battalion, and a lot more guys died in those two
days.
That's right. Is it possible that getting wounded when you did could have saved your life?
Very, very likely. From what some of the guys told me, the day that I got hit, after the barrage, they made their way forward, but they had a tough time. That was the 29th, 28th, the next day was the 29th. They could hear firepower. But it was not coming at them. So they knew that must be where the Americans were trapped because the Germans were shooting at them. Mm-hmm. So now that, you know, the incentive is to get going. So they knew they had to get going. So the 29th and 30th, when they broke through on the 30th, it was really a bloody, what we call bonsai charges. I don't know if you understand that word.
Well, but, yeah. Usually you hear it associated
all
with...
all-out charge,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And, in fact, a couple of weeks ago, I was in Denver for the memorial service for Joe Sakato, who was the last of our 21 Medal of Honor awards. And I spoke at his service, and he tells how he went goofy and made that bonsai charge, you know, and just went crazy. But that's what they had to do to make that last charge to get through, break through. Mm-hmm. But so there were a lot of casualties in that last day or so.
Including him.
Yeah. He got his on the 29th.
Yes, he did. And you heard Mr. Sakai mention speaking at Joe Sakato's funeral. Joe passed away in December 2015, but 4 years earlier, he told his story on Hometown Heroes. And we're going to hear his account of the day he earned the Medal of Honor when this special 442 edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking episode number 442 of this program with a tribute to the 442, the Gopher Broke soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, a segregated unit of Japanese Americans who risked their lives while their families were held captive back home in the States. In the year 2000, President Bill Clinton upgraded the decorations of 19 veterans from the 442 to our nation's highest military award, the Medal of Honor. One of those was Joe Sakato, who passed away in December 2015 at the age of 94. 4 years earlier, when I sat in his living room in Denver, Colorado, I wanted to get his reaction to his Medal of Honor citation, which originally accompanied the Distinguished Service Cross. Private George T. Sakato distinguished himself by extraordinary heroism in action on 29 October 1944 on Hill 617 in the vicinity of Bifontaine, France. After his platoon had virtually destroyed 2 enemy defense lines, during which he personally killed 5 enemy soldiers and captured 4, his unit was pinned down by heavy enemy fire. Disregarding the enemy fire, Private Sakato made a one-man rush that encouraged his platoon to charge and destroy the enemy strong point. While his platoon was reorganizing, he proved to be the inspiration of his squad in halting a counterattack on the left flank, during which his squad leader was killed. Taking charge of the squad, he continued his relentless tactics, using an enemy rifle and P-38 pistol to stop an organized enemy attack. During this entire action, he killed 12 and wounded 2, personally captured 4, and assisted his platoon in taking 34 prisoners. By continuously ignoring enemy fire, and by his gallant courage and fighting spirit, he turned impending defeat into victory and helped his platoon complete its mission. Private Sakato's extraordinary heroism and devotion to duty are in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit on him, his unit, and the United States Army. And when they said that, they gave you the Congressional Medal of Honor, the highest decoration that anyone in our armed forces can receive.
That was 50 years later.
President Bill Clinton pinned it on you. You've got a picture of it right here. When they did that, and I'm sure you were proud to have received the Distinguished Service Cross, I'm sure it made you think of all your fellow soldiers who died in that process. But what did it mean to you to receive the highest honor that our government can give?
I couldn't believe I was getting the Medal of Honor. To me, I wear this medal for those that didn't come home. The first day fell from Washington, gets killed and died, just loss of blood. The other 3 guys got sniper wounds. Right next to me, just in arm's length. 3 of them got killed, and I wondered, how was it that I'm able to come out of this alive and to be able to receive this medal? I didn't deserve this medal. I was doing what I was supposed to do, my duty, and when I wear this medal, I wear it for those that didn't make it back, and I also wear it for 1 German that I shot. I went on a patrol, we got down and we heard this German giving instructions and the machine gun opens up and one of the fellas dang near got shot. And I saw this German that was giving the orders and I shot him and I shot him in the legs, thighs. He went down and he saw me, then he picked up his gun and when he picked up his gun I shot him again, I shot him in the groin and I took off back to our lines, and I hear you screaming and crying for help. And then when I got on top of the hill, our lines, and he's still screaming, and boom, no more screaming. I wonder what happened.
Next day we went over and took the hill. I checked on the fella that I shot. He was in so much pain that he took a grenade and blew himself up, committed suicide. He never went home. So I wear this for him too.
This all happens with the Congressional Medal of Honor more than 50 years after World War II. You've come home. You've had the privilege of having a family that so many of your fellow soldiers didn't get to come home and do. You worked for the post office for more than 30 years, and you're just happy in retirement. How did you find out that you're going to get the Congressional Medal of Honor?
I couldn't believe it. Guys, I thought somebody was pulling my leg. He said, no, come to Washington. What? No, really? There's only 10 in the family that come, though, because it's going to be in the Rose Garden. And I said, well, 20 of us are going to get 10, that's 200 and some people. They'll never get in the Rose Garden. So I says, well, send me my medal. I don't need to go there. No, you got to come. So I finally get over there, and so happens a Saudi prince from Arabia had come to Washington, and they put up this big tent, plastic chandeliers, and had trees and shrubbies and air conditioned, and 500 people sitting there. So we finally got everybody in, and then I'm on the stage, and Bill Clinton comes up, and he calls my name, and I get up, and I look at him. I had to look up. He's pretty tall. I got up, and he's putting this on me, and he shakes my hand, and he says, I still couldn't believe that I was getting this Medal of Honor. And I says, no, this doesn't seem right. But like I say, so I wear this not as a hero. I wear this for those who never made it back home.
And that was in 2000 when you received the Congressional Medal of Honor. But you were in Washington, D.C. again recently to receive the Congressional Gold Medal, which is something that was given to all the Nisei veterans of World War II. How meaningful was that for you to see all these other men who had not been recognized for so long, maybe whose service and sacrifice while their families were being held prisoner really wasn't fully understood? How meaningful was that for you to be there with all of them and receive that honor?
I couldn't believe we were getting this gold medal. I said, well, what? So we go to Washington, and 8,000 people over there, 100 and some of his veterans were there, and we each got this medal, and it's a bronze duplicate of the gold medal. I didn't get the gold medal. They gave me just a bronze duplicate of the Congressional Gold Medal.
Well, I bet you had some really memorable interactions with other Nisei veterans of World War II.
Yes. When we get together, we talk stories. We call it. Where were you when they did? Well, I was over there when they buy with what's his name, or what's his name was over there. So it's good to be able to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so I get this duplicate bronze medal. Mm-hmm. There's four color guards in front, and the rest of the platoons are looking forward. Mm-hmm. Top is the
MIS?
MIS, Military Intelligence Service, the 100 battalions on the left, and 442nd on the right-hand side. We all received the gold medal award from Washington, D.C.
Was that some sense of closure for you to see how much it changed over 70 years since Pearl Harbor happened and President Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, and you and so many other Japanese Americans became enemy aliens?
Yes, this was a closure for me. This way I could feel we all received a duplicate of the gold medal award, so this kind of helps relieve the thought of all the men that had died, and we were able to receive this as a closure for our battles in Europe and Pacific. It's something else to be look at, to see and hold. It kind of puts me at ease. I still have nightmares. I still remember some days I'm in battle. I wake up, but when I wake up, I'm in my room. Well, I'm home. Like I say, I still have memories I can remember every day, every battle I've been in, and I talk about it. If I had to keep it in myself, I would be in a nut house, crazy house. So you don't hold it in you. If you don't talk about it, you keep it in yourself, you're going to lose your mind.
Well, I'm glad you're talking about it, and I'm curious what you think is important for the rest of us who weren't there, who didn't live through this time, who didn't see firsthand what the Gopher Broke unit, the 442nd, endured. What do you think is important for us to know going forward about what you and all those other soldiers did?
We had to prove our loyalty, that we were our Americans, and this proves that we were there, and we finally fought both battles of discrimination and the battle of Europe and the Pacific Islands. So this eases our pain that we have to suffer for so many years. 70 years ago, but I can still remember every battle. I don't know how, but I talk about it, and I want to talk to the soldiers of Iraq and Arabia, Afghanistan, to talk about it. Don't hold it into you and talk. Otherwise, you're going to be in a sanitarium somewhere and never get out. At least talk about it to ease your pain. And you'll feel a whole lot better once you've talked about it.
Well, you have lots of things that remind you of your time with the 442nd. You're wearing the Congressional Medal of Honor around your neck. We were looking at the Congressional Gold Medal you recently received. You have all the memories, and you have a little souvenir that the Germans gave you, too. What's that all about?
That's a little piece of shrapnel that went through my pack and went through my overcoat and it was hit my spine and ricocheted into my left lung. So now, right now it's in the area that it won't move or anything. It'll form a gristle around it. And so the upper half of my lungs, left lung, is collapsed with the shrapnel with gristles around it. So that's protecting my lungs. But every time I get an x-ray of my lungs and they see this little small souvenirs in there, and I wonder, what is that? That's a German souvenir that the Germans gave me.
I'm sure you've gotten some interesting reactions from that.
X-ray technician says, "Wow, look at that thing. What's that?" They're wondering what was all the little black dots in the set in my left lung, and they wonder what the heck that was. Now they know, so I had to tell them that this is a piece of German souvenir that they gave me.
And I imagine that's one more thing that reminds you how fortunate you are and how close you came to it being you as one of the 400,000 Americans who died in World War II.
Yeah, if I didn't have the overcoat in there, it would have probably severed my spine and I wouldn't be here.
If you didn't have the overcoat, if you hadn't stolen the Tommy gun from the tank, yeah, you probably wouldn't be here, huh?
Right. That all that plays in the same area that helped me get along and come out of the war in extra pieces, but I made it back home, so it made it real nice. I'm proud that I survived and I was able to go through. And I was able to do the in battle and come out alive and still be able to talk about it. And I'm glad I'm home now. It feels real good to be home.
Now he truly is home as of December 2015. That's Joe Sicato, the last of 21 Medal of Honor recipients from the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. I have several links for you at hometownheroesradio.com if you'd like to explore this unique chapter in American history. And nobody has done that better than the Go for Broke National Education Center and its Hanashi Oral History Program. I'd encourage you to check that out. I've got the links there for you. And join us again next time when we hear from a wounded World War II bombardier who went on to be a renowned hunting guide. Thanks for listening to episode 442. Maybe that number will carry as much meaning for you now as it does for me. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.